It goes without saying that anything that happens in the United States has an enormous impact on the rest of the world, last election, for example, and conversely, that's important to remember. What happens in the rest of the world has cannot fail to have an important, in fact, decisive, crucial, often, impact in the United States. And that happens in several ways. For one thing, it sets constraints on what even the most powerful state can do. But in a more significant way, what happens elsewhere, like here, influences the domestic component of what the New York Times ruefully described as the second superpower, namely world public opinion, after the enormous protests against the right before the Iraq invasion. And those protests were a critically important historical event. First of all, their scale was quite unprecedented, but also it was the first time in hundreds of years of the history of Europe and its North American offshoots that a war was protested, and in fact massively protested, before it was officially launched. Take, say, by comparison, the war, what's called the Vietnam War, actually the war against South Vietnam, that was launched by John F. Kennedy in 1962. It was brutal and barbaric from the outset. Began with bombing of unprotected civilian targets, chemical warfare to destroy food crops so as to starve out the civilian support for the indigenous resistance, programs to drive millions of people to virtual concentration camps or urban slums to eliminate the popular base for the resistance. By the time protests reached the substantial scale, 67, the highly respected and quite hawkish Vietnam specialist and military historian Bernard Fall wondered, quoting him, whether Vietnam as a cultural and historic entity would escape extinction as the countryside literally dies under the blows of the largest military machine ever unleashed on an area of this size. It was particularly South Vietnam, which was always the main target of the U.S. assault. And when protest finally did develop, many years too late, it was mostly directed against the peripheral crimes, the extension of the war to the north and the rest of Indochina. These were terrible crimes, but lesser ones. And it's quite important to remember how much the world has changed since then through deeply committed popular struggle. It's far too late in developing, but ultimately it was effective. The most interesting part of the Pentagon Papers, which is rarely mentioned for good reasons, is the last section. Pentagon Papers ends middle of 1968. January 68 was the Tet Offensive, which convinced corporate elite in the United States that the war just wasn't worth it. And the U.S. had won many of its objectives. It had destroyed any serious hope of independent, successful development in Vietnam, which was its main purpose, as in many other cases. And it was just becoming too costly for the United States, too costly because of the rising anti-war movement, which was compelling the president to fight what was called a guns and butter war. Couldn't declare a national mobilization, but had to kind of buy the population off because there was just too much disruption. And it turns out that right after the Tet Offensive, the president wanted to send 200,000 more troops to South Vietnam, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff objected. They didn't want to do it, and they refused. And the reason they said is that they would need those troops for civil disorder control in the United States because of the rising protests among women, young people, minorities, in fact, a large part of the population. So it was just too dangerous to send more troops to Indochina. That continued and grew. When Ronald Reagan came into office, he tried to duplicate what John F. Kennedy had done in South Vietnam 20 years earlier. And the target then was Central America, under what was called, incidentally, a war against terror. Was declared in 1981, not in 2001. They had to back off because there was just too much spontaneous protest from church groups, from by then and all over mainstream, the mainstream of the country, not just young people and so on. So they backed off, and they turned to what was called clandestine war. Clandestine war is a technical term that means a war that everybody knows about except the population of the United States. And they don't know it for a good reason, which some people have something to answer for about. So the Reagan administration fought this clandestine war with a huge international terror network. So the cover War on Terror, Orwell would have appreciated. That was terrible enough. A couple hundred thousand people were killed, four countries devastated. But it wasn't B-52s, which are much worse, and it wasn't mass murder operations, which happened to be peaking in 1969, at the time when John Kerry was deep in the Mekong Delta in the south, which by then had been largely devastated. The popular reaction to even the clandestine war, which, as it was called, also broke new ground in history, another historically unprecedented development. That was the origin of the solidarity movements for Central America, which were coming right out of the mainstream. Thousands, in fact, tens of thousands of people from the United States actually went to help the victims. That had never happened in the history of European imperialism or its North American offshoots. And by now they're all over the world. That's again something entirely new in Western history and another testimony to the success of these movements, of which there are many. Well, without forgetting the very significant progress towards more civilized societies, which has taken place in the past years, and crucially the reasons for it, namely popular engagement and struggle, let's focus nevertheless on the present and on the topic that was suggested for this evening, the notions of imperial sovereignty that are now being crafted. It's not surprising that as the population becomes more civilized, power systems become more extreme in their efforts to control the great beast, as the founding fathers of U.S. society called the people, the hated and feared people. The conceptions of popular sovereignty that are being crafted by the radical statist reactionaries of the Bush administration are in fact so extreme that they've drawn unprecedented criticism in the most sober and respected establishment circles. Actually, it's pretty helpful to people like me. Instead of quoting, sort of far-out types, you can quote the most respectable mainstream journals, and they're saying more, stronger things than you might have said yourself. The administration's ideas of presidential sovereignty were transmitted to the president by the newly appointed attorney general, Alberto Gonzalez. At that time, he was the president's counsel, and he's depicted now as a moderate in the press. His views on this are discussed by the very respected constitutional law professor, Sanford Levinson, in the current issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. You can't get more respectable than that. Levinson writes that the conception being crafted by the Justice Department, transmitted by Gonzalez, is based on the principle that, quoting, there exists no norm that is applicable to chaos. And that quote, as Levinson comments, is from Carl Schmitt, who was the leading German philosopher of law during the Nazi period. The administration, advised by Gonzalez, has, quoting Levinson, has articulated a view of presidential authority that is all too close to the power that Schmitt was willing to accord his own Führer. One rarely hears words like that from the heart of the establishment. The same issue of that super respectable journal has an article by two leading strategic analysts, on what's called the transformation of the military. It's another component of the new doctrines of imperial sovereignty that are being crafted. That's the rapid expansion of offensive weaponry, including the militarization of space, in this case joined apparently by Canada, and other measures that are designed to place the entire world at risk of instant annihilation. And these have elicited the anticipated reactions by potential targets, Russia and China, who are developing their own offensive weaponry in order to overwhelm it. These two analysts conclude that the U.S. programs may lead to, in their words, ultimate doom. And they express their hope that a coalition of peace-loving nations will coalesce as a counter to U.S. Militarism and aggressiveness, a coalition led by China. Now, we've come to a pretty pass when such sentiments are voiced in sober and respectable circles, which aren't given to hyperbole, and when their faith in U.S. democracy is so slight that they look to China to save us from marching towards ultimate doom. And it's up to the second superpower to decide whether that contempt for the great beast is warranted. Well, going back to Gonzalez, the president's counsel then, he transmitted to the president the conclusion of the Justice Department that the president has the authority to rescind the Geneva Conventions. It's the supreme law of the land under the U.S. Constitution and the foundation of modern international humanitarian law. And Gonzalez advised the president that this would be a good idea. In his words, it substantially reduces the threat of domestic criminal prosecution of administration officials under the War Crimes Act of 1996, which carries the death penalty for grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. So he better rescind them quickly. Well, we can see right on today's front pages why the Justice Department was right to be concerned that the president and his advisors might be subject to the death penalty under the laws passed by the Republican Congress in 1996. And, of course, under the principles of Nuremberg, if anyone took them seriously. 2 weeks ago, on the front page of the New York Times, prominently displayed, was a picture of Fallujah General Hospital. The accompanying story said, patients and hospital employees were rushed out of rooms by armed soldiers and ordered to sit or lie on the floor while troops tied their hands behind their backs. And that's what the picture shows, armed soldiers standing over people lying, patients and doctors lying on the floor with their hands tied behind their backs. And that's described in the stories, in the front page stories, an important achievement. Quote, New York Times, it shut down a propaganda weapon for the militants. Fallujah General Hospital had been producing a stream of reports of civilian casualties, and these inflated figures, I mean inflated because our leader so declares, were inflaming opinion throughout the country and the region, driving up the political costs of the conflict. Incidentally, the word conflict is by now a common euphemism for U.S. aggression, as when we read on the same front pages that the U.S. must now rebuild what the conflict just destroyed. A conflict has no agent. It's kind of like a hurricane that happens, and then we have to come in and rebuild it. Well, let's go back to the picture and the story about the closing of the propaganda weapon, the main hospital. There are some relevant documents, including the Geneva Conventions. So here's a principle of the Geneva Conventions. Fixed establishments and mobile medical units of the medical service may in no circumstances be attacked and shall at all times be respected and protected by parties to the conflict. So page one of the world's leading newspaper is cheerfully depicting war crimes for which the political leadership could be sentenced to death under U.S. law. No wonder that the Attorney General warned the president as his counsel, that he should use the constitutional authority that the Justice Department concocted to rescind the supreme law of the land, adopting the concept of presidential sovereignty devised by Hitler's primary legal advisor, the true Eminence Grise of the Bush administration, according to a distinguished conservative authority on constitutional law, writing in perhaps the most respectable and sober journal in the country. Well, the world's greatest newspaper also tells us, quote it, that the U.S. military achieved nearly all their objectives in Fallujah well ahead of schedule, leaving much of the city in smoking ruins. But it was not, I'm quoting it, but it was not a complete success. Why? There was little evidence of dead pack rats in their warrens or the streets. Those are their words, not mine. They did find a body of a dead woman, though it's not known whether she was an Iraqi or a foreigner. That's the only question that's raised, and apparently the only one that comes to mind. This is all right in the front pages of the world's greatest newspaper. The front page account also quotes a Marine commander who says, it ought to go down in the history books. Perhaps it should. If so, we know very well on what page of history it'll go down and who will be right beside it, along with those who praise it or, for that matter, even tolerate it. Well, it could be argued that all this is irrelevant. The Nuremberg Tribunal, spelling out the UN Charter, declared that, quoting it, initiation of a war of aggression is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole, hence the war crimes in Fallujah, Abu Ghraib, and so on. Those judged to have played any role in the supreme crime, for example, the German foreign minister, were sentenced to death by hanging. And the Tokyo Tribunal was far more severe. That is an important book on this topic. If you haven't read it, you should, by the Canadian international lawyer Michael Mandel, who reviews in unfortunately convincing detail how the powerful have become self-immunized from international law. That when the United States signed the Genocide Convention, the U.S. finally did sign it after 40 years, it signed it with a reservation, saying that it is inapplicable to the United States. And the rules of the World Court say that they can only deal with something if both sides are subjected to its jurisdiction. Now, there was an outraged comment on the efforts of the Justice Department lawyers to demonstrate that the president has the right to authorize torture, a comment by the dean of Yale Law School, Howard Koh. And he said that the notion that the president has the constitutional power to permit torture is like saying that he has the constitutional power to commit genocide. Well, the president's legal advisors, like the new attorney general, should have little difficulty arguing that the president indeed does have that power if the second superpower, us, permits him to exercise it. Let's look at the pretext for the U.S.-British aggression in Iraq, the supreme international crime that encompasses everything that follows. The pretext was the right of what's called anticipatory self-defense. Now it's sometimes called preemptive war in a radical perversion of that concept. This right of anticipatory self-defense was proclaimed officially in the Bush administration National Security Strategy of September 2002, which declared Washington's right to resort to force to eliminate any potential challenge to its global dominance, any potential threat, if you like. The National Security Strategy was very widely criticized among the foreign policy elite right away. There was an article within weeks in the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, which warned that what it called the new imperial grand strategy could be very dangerous for the United States. And the criticism continued, again at a completely unprecedented level, right in the core of the mainstream, but on very narrow grounds. It was not that the doctrine was wrong, but rather its style and manner of implementation. Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, she summed up the criticism pretty accurately, also in Foreign Affairs, it's, you know, the main establishment journal. She pointed out that every president has such a doctrine, but keeps it in his back pocket. And it's simply foolish to smash people in the face with it and to implement it in a manner that's going to infuriate even allies. That's threatening to U.S. interests and therefore wrong. Albright knew, of course, that Clinton had a similar doctrine. The Clinton doctrine, I'll quote it, advocated unilateral use of military power to defend vital interests, such as ensuring uninhibited access to key markets, energy supplies, and strategic resources. That's without even the pretexts that Bush and Blair devised. You take it literally, the Clinton doctrine is more expansive than Bush's national security strategy. But unlike the Bush strategy, the more expansive Clinton doctrine was barely even reported. In fact, I'm not sure it was reported at all, and not criticized. And the reason is it was presented with the right style and implemented less brazenly. That's the way you should do it if you're looking for a career in diplomacy. Henry Kissinger described the Bush doctrine as, in his words, revolutionary. He pointed out that it undermines the 17th Westphalian system of international order and sovereignty, and of course he didn't even bother mentioning it. It undermines the UN Charter and current international law. Kissinger approved of the doctrine, but with reservations, the usual reservations about style and tactics, and with a crucial qualification. He said, it cannot be a universal principle available to every nation. Rather, the right of aggression must be reserved to the United States, perhaps delegated to chosen clients. So we must forcefully reject the principle of universality, the principle that we apply to ourselves, the same standards we apply to others, more stringent ones if we are serious. Bush and Blair, who we're told read the Gospels religiously all the time, must know the famous definition of the hypocrite in the Gospels, repeated a couple of times. But maybe it didn't get from the eyes to what lies behind or whatever. And Kissinger, I think, is to be praised as often for his honesty in very forthrightly articulating the prevailing doctrines, which are usually concealed in professions of virtuous intent and tortured legalisms. And Kissinger also understands his educated audience. As he doubtless expected, there was no reaction. Well, his understanding of his audience was illustrated again rather dramatically just a couple of months ago, last May. I don't know if it was reported here, some Kissinger-Nixon tapes were released over Kissinger's strong objections. And there was a report in the world's leading journal, New York Times. The report mentioned in passing the orders to bomb Cambodia that Kissinger transmitted from Nixon to the military commanders. In his word, a massive bombing campaign in Cambodia, anything that flies on anything that moves. You get that? Anything that flies on anything that moves. Well, I think that's unique in the archival record. At least I never come across a call for genocide in such explicit terms. The publication, we'd certainly call it genocide if anybody else were responsible. And this is a call for it. The publication elicited no reaction. That incidentally refutes Dean Koh of the Yale Law School. It is simply taken for granted in the elite intellectual culture that the president and his national security advisor do have the right to order genocide, contrary to Koh's outraged claim. Well, just imagine if the prosecutors at the Milosevic Tribunal could find anything even remotely similar. Well, they'd be overjoyed. You know, trial would be over, several life sentences, death penalty if it adhered to U.S. law. But remember, that's them, not us. And the difference is a core principle of the elite intellectual culture in the West, and in fact throughout history rather generally, if you look, it's very easy to continue, but too easy in fact, so I won't go on with some other examples I was going to go into. All of this, you know, cite examples at length, it's hard to find an exception. It does leave open a crucial question. How does the great beast react? That is the domestic U.S. counterpart of the second superpower. Well, there's a conventional answer. That is that the population approves of all of this, as was just shown again by the election of George Bush, leading to, 150,000 people trying to come north. But they're misunderstanding what happened. And as is often the case, a closer look is helpful. So let's take a slightly closer look.